Tepic y Guanajuato a Centroamérica sin censura. KPFK 90.7 FM Los Ángeles, California. En San Diego 93.7. En Santa Bárbara 98.7 FM. Y en Ridgecrest 99.5 FM. Chau chau kamik, ketamaj, deja cultura maya, deja dikil, deja tiak, deja música y deja chabal, le quiche y los otros 31 idiomas. Dios chihue kohi kohitatabehui, Dios chihue hawi kishaketahui, utsipetik chawe chau kamik chik. Bienvenidos a Centroamérica sin censura. En nuestro espacio de hoy, nuestro enfoque es levantar la cultura maya con su servidor Mr. Tambriz. KPFK 90.7 FM Los Ángeles, 98.7 FM Santa Bárbara, 93.7 FM Norte de San Diego y 99.5 FM Ridgecrest. La cultura maya es más conocida por sus idiomas, vestimentos tradicionales, sus platos tradicionales y sin faltar el deleite musical. Thank you so much for listening to us. Welcome to Centroamérica sin censura. Tonight we are going to talk about Maya language, traditional dress, traditional food, and delightful traditional Maya music. You are listening to KPFK 19.7 FM Los Ángeles, 98.7 FM Santa Bárbara, 93.7 FM North San Diego, 99.5 FM Ridgecrest. Worldwide, www.kpfk.org. Hats kabir te wa chaqab kamik, koch aw te le qachabal, le qatsiaq, le qarikil, ito qe le qashawem, le qamusika, de hela le Guatemala. Che wa chaqab kamik, kawahin tatnan, hawikini tatabehwe, le qachabal kiche, ne qasach taba, ne qayata betek, qasach le qachabal le kiche, komala qila, kota qakala ki e paletihobal, che wa qih kamik, ke ketamah ingles, ke ketamah kashlantzih, pero le qachabal kiche, ne qayata kanok, qakama babek qonohel, qila ba qask qanche, nintita qakala ki ketamah le ki aletak che, chush nimaq, choke ke kikot kuko, para ki qayaka nok hunki legado, le qachabal le kiche. Choke che re qahastak, re qashahab, reka pantalon, reka katsiak, kutim, kustar, rekuk, reshokib, nekasachta, kakama bik, ka na continuar, kakoho, reka hashtag, na kokishta patakbe, kawinak lancheke, tsen chkawochke, kakan burla chke, per nekayata bechke la rencheke, kakan burlar reka hashtag, porque hun ulegao choke kiyam kanok reka tat kanan de maya, y ka anaba sentir orgulloso chkiwach reka tat kanan, de nimatakibantahik. Kewa 200 años y kakamaba big choker karikil kilaba haskana patak kun nikahtak dinamit nikahtak pais kakamaba big la karikil ka kila hask kanche para ke li shokib na ke kisachtak haska anche unikri karikil kila para ishimu leo ke es Guatemala choker de kachabal kiche choker kubig pale musika de ojom, de chirimilla, de cachojowem, choque que cambie parte de la tradición de maya. Como veníamos diciendo en el quiche que estuve hablando de idiomas, vestimento, comida y música. Voy a traducir un poco lo que dije en quiche. Lo siguiente son: el idioma no hay que dejarlo, el idioma maya como quiche, canjobal, tzutujil, mam u otros idiomas, hay que levantarlo. Es una tradición muy poderosa que nuestros ancestros nos dejaron. Deberíamos sentirnos hasta más orgullosos de decir si yo sé hablar un idioma extra. Entonces, y a través de eso también vamos a estar comprendiendo qué tan importante es el idioma maya. Ahora vamos a pasar al otro punto, que es el vestimento. También hay que tomar muy en cuenta que nuestro vestimento, que nuestra naturaleza, que nuestros coloridos que viene en las ropas huipiles, en otras tejedores y todo eso, es parte de nuestra cultura, es parte de nuestra tradición, es parte de nuestro ser que tenemos por dentro como maya. Entonces, y otra cosa, yo he visto mucha gente que se burlan de uno por poner una ropa tradicional. Algunas personas hacen eso, pero nosotros no nos vamos a dejar caer por eso. Nosotros tenemos que demostrar que somos tan orgullosos de nuestros poderes que tenemos por dentro como seres humanos, demostrando quiénes somos en realidad, que somos mayas de verdad. Y el otro tema que estuve tocando también, que es la comida, la rica comida guatemalteca, un plato de pepián, un plato de comida que es hecho por mujeres guatemaltecas. Wow, qué rico. Deberíamos llevar esto más allá, abrir más restaurantes con comidas tradicionales de Guatemala, como por ejemplo acá en Los Ángeles hay pocos, y algunas personas que vienen desde San Diego me han preguntado dónde encuentro un restaurante donde hacen la comida guatemalteca. Entonces es muy muy bueno escuchar esto, que nuestra comida, la comida sí, las personas de verdad que han presenciado, han saboreado la comida típica de Guatemala, es lo más delicioso que puede haber en este mundo. Y nuestra música sin faltar, la música marimba con sus chirimías, nuestros bailes también. Pues ¿a quién no le gusta la música en marimba? En escuchar, en deleitar esos sentidos, y llega, estimula tus sentidos con esa música, es lo más precioso que hay, es lo más precioso que nos dejaron nuestros antepasados, nuestros padres mayas y todo eso. Y la verdad, pues a mí me gusta mucho la música guatemala, me encanta. Algunas que conocemos, ¿verdad?, como el reguiche, es un poco más famoso. Esa música, de verdad, son de lo mejor que hay. As I mentioned in Quiché, in Spanish, when I start this segment, I would now like to translate for my English listeners. The first thing I was talking about, Mayan languages. We got 32 languages in Guatemala, which is beautiful, which is wow, it's powerful. I've been teaching Quiché for several years. I saw many people, they really interested to learn Mayan languages. Why? Because they know that the beautiful language in Central America, that's the best one, which is we are learning, we are getting to what our ancestors, they left in this land, which is Guatemala, also Mexico. They got 54 languages, different languages. So I would say that it's really, really cool when you learn and when you speak and when you can write like in any languages like Quiché, like Cajobal or others languages in Guatemala. So, and also I was talking about the traditional dress. So in Guatemala we have a lot of traditional dress, like we call the huipil, we call a lot of things, which is really, really cool, colorful. We have a lot of things like so beautiful. It's representing the beautiful inside of the person. It's something like they show an outside. Not only the soul of the person, also you can see like on the traditional dress. And also I was talking about food, traditional food, which is delicious, which is you can't really, really, you can really enjoy the food with the tortillas, with a lot of plates of food, which is traditional from Guatemala. So I was talking about open up more restaurants, like Mayan restaurant, like traditional food from Guatemala. So it's really, really interesting when you hear some people like, hey, we need more traditional food in USA. We need more traditional dress, where you can buy traditional dress in USA. So it's really, really cool when you hear those things, because it makes you proud of where you come from. In music, in Quiché, which is with the marimba and other instruments, oh my gosh, just believe me, just like it's going in your soul, and then you can dance by yourself in different music with the marimba, with other instruments. In Guatemala we have a lot of people, like Mayan people, they create their own instrument, like the marimba. They create their own marimba instrument. They can still use them because they give us a beautiful, beautiful music, beautiful language, beautiful traditional dress, beautiful food. So, and also I can say that I'm so proud of myself that I could be a Maya trilingual person. Thank you for listening. Muchas gracias por escucharnos. Gracias por su apoyo. Gracias por su tiempo. Dios chiwe, shojita taberche ocha apkamik. Dios chiwe, choje anchele apoyo ki anchele leka radio. KPFK. Choque, quien ya fue Matios Chihue, Hawi, cojita tapejue, aunque te amta hasa ahora, Hawi, cojita tapejue, pero Tios Chihue, Arecuara, servidor Atambriz, para Estados Unidos, choque de jinkin cachreno rinutir vale quiche y choque le Centroamérica sin censura dios chihue che unoje choque tatapej choque quichunico jito KPFK vale 90.7 FM Los Ángeles vale 98.7 FM Santa Bárbara vale 93.7 FM And welcome to another edition of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. This one also a flashback edition. You are, of course, tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 if you're listening on your radio, or freakradio.org if you're listening on a computer or online. Your host is still out of it as far as actually creating new shows and doing new interviews, but I do a few, and there will be a kind of a brief introduction before this show. This is part of that brief introduction. But the show itself will mainly be, almost entirely be, a flashback and repetition of the April 14th, 2011 show, which features some interesting stuff. A long interview with chess master and homeless activist Mark Brody. Well, survivor, perhaps, rather than activist, as well as a long interview with Mike Rhodes, who is a writer from Fresno, who has also been organizing homeless folks, and at one point, with others, successfully won $2.3 million for homeless folks in Fresno, stopping the Parks and Rec and Caltrain and the city authorities generally from seizing and destroying homeless property, something we're still fighting here in Santa Cruz. To begin the show, I'll have a few additional announcements, and then we'll launch into our little time machine back to yesteryear. And if you have any thoughts on the show, or if you have any reports you want to make, there is a number you can use, 423-4833, 423-4833, area code 831. You might not reach a real person, but you can give a report to the actual recording machine, and hopefully I'll be able to put it on a future show.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. songs, they simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you. Sing me of wars and sing me of bread lines. Tell me of front page news. Sing me of strikes and last minute headlines. Dress your observation in syncopation. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must get hot with what is what, or I won't love you. I want a song that's satirical, putting the mirror into miracle. It must be packed with social fact, or I won't love you. Sing me of kings and conferences martial. Tell me of mills and mines. Sing me of courts that aren't impartial. What's to be done with them? Tell me in rhythm. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must be tense with common sense, or I won't love you.
So, as some of you may have heard, Food Not Bombs activist Keith McHenry suffered a serious medical incident on Sunday. He was hospitalized and had surgery regarding a back and leg problem, but seemed to be in at least talkable shape when I spoke with him in the hospital on, it was Monday or Tuesday, and that was 3 or 4 days ago. So I'm hoping he's going to come out of that pretty well. The sleep out, and I think it's number 105, though I'm a little muddled on the numbers, the freedom sleepouts that occur in front of City Hall every Tuesday night. I did get a call from someone down there who told me they were concerned because nobody was there. And I had thought, well, it looks like without Food Not Bombs serving food, and Keith, of course, couldn't be serving, he's sort of the main person on Tuesdays serving food, that the sleep out might have to be postponed or not happened. But I learned today from activist pushback Pat Colby, who lives in her vehicle with her brother, that in fact there was a sleep out. People did show up with signs. They slept the night. They weathered massive police harassment in the morning. There were, I'm not quite sure if it's somewhere between 10 and 20 people were there, even without some of the conventional leaders from the Food Not Bombs group, although perhaps some of them were there too. I don't have a lot of details, but that was really quite encouraging to me. There was also a video that activist Wes White, Salinas activist Wes White, who frequently comes over to Santa Cruz to, well, video events and then post them, which is even better. We get a lot of folks doing video, it seems, but then the amount of posting is limited online, so that seems to be the point that's basically missed often. But for Wes, he is a perennial poster. Coalition on Homelessness is a group that Brent Adams and others have organized, but I think mostly Brent, which is concerned with, I think, uniting different service providers and elements of the community, not apparently including protest groups, although he may have invited them.
I don't know if Huff actually received an invitation, and I don't know if Food Now Bombs did, but the latest video of Brent's two-hour meeting, which included presentations by himself, by Robert Aguirre of a San Jose homeless organization, by Miley, a librarian who's been doing the Thursday morning kind of coffee clutches that happen every 10 o'clock outside the main library, the same library they're fencing off, the same library where benches are being removed, the same library that is closed completely, when, including the grounds outside, when there is when the building is closed in this new attempt to drive away homeless people who sort of huddle there after hours. And of all people, Rochelle Noroyan, one of the most reactionary members of the city council, who pressed for the ban all RVs from Santa Cruz law, which was at least held in abeyance by the Coastal Commission. As far as I know, that hasn't changed. She, too, was there and apparently gets some credit for sitting through the end of the meeting. But to me, you can go actually see this whole thing yourself online as a video. And you can just go to Food Not Bombs Facebook page and you'll be able to find the Coalition on Homelessness video. Strangely enough, I wasn't able to find it under the Coalition on Homelessness Facebook page, but perhaps it'll be posted there later. There's interesting information from Brent Adams, who has been quite a traveler and quite a chronicler of encampments and attempts to establish homeless survival activity in other jurisdictions and other places up and down the coast. And there's some discussion from an audience, which included 40 or 50 people. I'll say no more about it at this point because you should go judge for yourself. To me, as well, I guess I will say it looked like the usual collection of chattering poverty pimps who didn't have too much to say other than, gee, we wish it were different, and if only we could convince the city council to do the right thing, and let's proceed along the lines of the city council's homelessness survey and report, which they put out in May, which essentially did not ask for any meaningful expanse in shelter or provide for it over the summer, and took no action against its out-of-control city manager, Martine Bernal, who is essentially directly attacking homeless survival here this summer in and around City Hall and elsewhere in the city by walling people off, giving them tickets, destroying protective community where it exists, and so forth. To jump back now to another time, April 14th, 2011, where we have activists Dana Dreamcatcher, Sherianna, Mark Brody, and Mike Rhodes, among others, talking about issues then that are still quite relevant, and hopefully they will not only educate you and give you some historical background, but they might encourage you to take some part in what's going on now and tomorrow on the streets of Santa Cruz.
On Wednesday morning, it's Free Coffee. We discuss issues of criminalization of the poor and how they can be exposed, mocked, and ultimately overturned. That's kind of what Huff is about. And that's what a lot of the show is about. I'm going to now turn to some street interviews, which kind of been piling up on my mighty and, I should say, somewhat disabled tape recorder, but I think it's still operational, and hopefully it'll remain operational for a little while, long enough at least to get this out on the air. I want to remind you that in case you hear something that you want to hear again or have a question about and can't get through to me on the line here at 427-3772, you can hear it again on the archives, which are at the Huff website, huffsantacruz.org. If you have trouble reaching the Huff website, which has been out of commission for about a week, you can again give me a call on the Huff line, and I'll give you an alternate address and a way to get to older shows, which could sometimes be useful. Anyway, here's some stuff. It's street interviews, voices from Pacific Avenue and elsewhere in the downtown. Well, you be the judge.
A rather gloomy fellow in front of Joe's Pizza and Subs. It is, of course, Monday, the 4th of April. And you, in fact, used to be a radio man, Mr. Thin Man, who used to be chunkier. Can you please tell me your name again?
Dana Cruz.
And Dana, you are a person who finds the current avenue. I mean, we're well guarded by the hosts and the police. They keep us lawful. They're friendly. I mean, look at that. Who could want more than that?
I don't know. Well, you know, I could go over the hill to Los Gatos. Looks just like this now. What's the difference? I mean, Santa Cruz used to be a place, a mecca, you know, difference. I mean, okay, I can hear one guy standing in front of the closing down Borders store playing a lonely guitar on a street corner, strumming as loudly as he can. Nobody even pays attention walking by anymore, you know? And you look up and down the avenue, all the street artists and performers, they're pretty much gone now. They've blown away from here. You know, and all the tourists have to see is the same thing that any other community like Los Gatos would have to offer, which is basically a bunch of shops and a cement sidewalk. That's about all I got to say there.
Dana, you yourself were a radio broadcaster for how long?
Nearly a year with free radio.
And finally you left because?
People are too complacent. Not enough activity, not enough activism in our the climate's gone cold. That's what I'd have to say. Yeah.
In fact, before we even began this interview, you kind of looked at me and said, what's the point,
right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What is the point, listeners?
Look around, look at all the other nations that are, look at all the other outcries in other nations. I mean, there's people like literally like screaming at their governments, you know, and it's just, there's a wash of complacency going on here. It scares me because I don't think people, I think we're way too insulated in America, folks. Wake up.
Unfortunately, this sounds true, but wouldn't want this message to get spread too far, Dana. Naturally, I'm going to have to feed you some French fries and shut you up. Maybe possibly a small apartment.
I've been placated enough. I managed to, you know, somehow have the money to afford a huge meal for only $3 today. It's great, you know. I mean, yeah, we're such a complacent, lazy, and rich nation anymore, and to see the less fortunate people just walked over in society is really bad.
There you have it. You know, the unvarnished truth from Dana Cruz. Well, I've just been reminded of a terror of tale. A tale of terror, something like that. One of those horror stories that about a very distinguished member of our community, Mr. Chip, who is, first name only, please. He goes by his first name, the executive director of the Downtown Association. You have a recollection of an incident that happened downtown involving a street youth named Yo-Yo, where Chip apparently got so upset with Yo-Yo that he whipped out a metal rod. Is that correct?
Yeah, I took it out of a newspaper stand in the side of the front of Quiznos, and first he threatened him and tried to strike him with that rod. Then afterwards, he came back and threatened Chip with a fake handgun. And it was arrested the same day.
Threatened Yo-Yo with a handgun?
Fake handgun,
and
yeah.
What was the reaction of Yo-Yo and the surrounding group of people?
Chip was taken to jail in the back of a Santa Cruz police car.
And afterwards, of course, patted on the back and elected to the executive directorship of the Downtown Association.
I suppose that's the way it goes, usually.
Promotion is, in fact, you know, a good idea for people who are standing up for the values of our community against the ne'er-do-wells and people of that sort. I hadn't heard that story, or if I have, I've had a blackout, so I don't know. It's interesting. This has probably happened 3 or 4 years ago, you think?
Around the summer of 08, summer of 2008.
Thank you. And of course, this is another tale from Dana Cruz, who was on the you were on the air at that time, yes?
Not quite. I was just looking into getting on the air back then with London, and then later collaborated, got on the air, started a show, and held it for about 9 months.
I remember. That was the time when there actually was a farmer's market drum circle.
Yeah, and I promoted it heavily. In fact, my show aired 10 to noon on Wednesday mornings ahead of the drum circle in the farmer's market, and that was one of the things I touted on the most. And I still think it's the tragedy that we've lost that and that they expanded the farmer's market, mostly in retaliation of people's freedom to assemble.
Well, I know also that there's an attack on what it seems to be an attack on the counterculture against Jabberwock, which you may have heard about. Jabberwock is a local head shop.
Yeah, I'm familiar with some of the people and stuff that's involved with that. Yeah, I feel bad about it, you know, because it's just another one of those things in the community that where a person's trying to find their niche and they're getting shoved out by other interests.
But luckily we have First Alarm Security keeping an eye on things.
Well, yeah, in case anybody wants to, you know, do something personal, like light up on a sidewalk or something, you can get reminded that you might be, you know, fined or thrown in jail or something.
Or possibly they could give you a ticket as a reminder.
Well, that's the fine, yeah, and that those could even lead to misdemeanors, which can lead to jail.
Well, yes, but the jails are places where the homeless can use to have lodging.
Yeah, three free meals and a cot.
If you like bologna sandwiches.
Well, nothing's free. Somebody had to pay for that, right? Didn't you pay for those tax monies?
Most of my money goes proudly to drone missiles over in Afghanistan. We've been talking with
Dana Cruz.
Thank you, Dana.
In front of the parking space number, who knows what, right across from
22.
Actually, it's 4068. Well, 4068 is over there, but we're in the parking lot behind Logos talking with
Dreamcatcher
and
Sherianna.
And the two of you have just had some, you had read in Huli, you had sex, but you've been wed in Huli wedlock?
Yes, thank you.
We had a computer wedding.
And you're both homeless.
Right?
No.
So you can get a wet shovel anywhere.
We're houseless at the moment.
But not homeless.
No. There's always a home. It's the sky above your head.
And I am literally.
As long as there's a priest in the house.
So what led you to this foolish choice, Dreamcatcher?
Trying to play a good fool.
And what about you, madam? Why would you possibly accept a catcher of dreams?
Well, it catches many things. Sometimes loogies.
I see we are becoming more and more seventh grade here.
Sometimes flies.
All right. That's
sometimes dreams.
And sometimes dreams. I will leave it at that and wish you both a very happy next 50 years.
Lent.
There won't be a next 50.
There you are. The pessimist in you.
30.
All right. So. We'll have to pause while we decipher that last bit of gobbledygook. Don't go away.
So, it's about 7 o'clock, and I'm down here on Pacific Avenue in front of New Leaf, a little bit before 7, actually. And we have the variety of drummers and guitarists, a group of about 4, including Mark and Wayne and goodness, a whole bunch of folks. And then across the street, in front of the going down fast borders, are, looks like, 6 youthful hacky sackers, sacky hacking away with so far no patrol or host interference, which is, of course, nice.
And hacky sacking, of course, is illegal on Pacific Avenue, anywhere in the anywhere in the downtown area, except in parks. So it's interesting to see the recurrence of kind of life on Pacific Avenue. An interesting contrast to Dana Cruz's perspective that we are sort of bereft of street music, and I think there is a really serious continuing repression of street musicians. I've talked about the specifics, whether you're trying to sing downtown with homeless lyrics or play a small keyboard near borders and the attorney upstairs doesn't like it, or I don't know, whether you're beating a drum like Tamarack, or whether you're displaying jewelry, which this isn't having to do with street performers, but more like street life, and you're getting hassled, or whether you're in a store and getting raided by the police and then ousted by the landlord for what sounds like opportunistic reasons around real what may really be a cultural war against a store like Jabberwock. There is a crackdown on Pacific Avenue and around in downtown area. And it's It's not unrelated to the makeup of the current city council, which includes Mayor Ryan Coonerty, Vice Mayor Don Lane, Lynn Robinson, Hillary Bryant, David Teresis, and other right-wingers or right-wing collaborationists around this whole situation. Hoping to get a report from Street Performers Guild activist Tom Noddy one of these weeks. He's kind of on tour and working in different cities. He's the famous bubble-blowing maestro who's also been instrumental in challenging some of the downtown ordinances at different times successfully and putting in a lot of energy trying to get people together to discuss the issues and maybe act on them if they feel so inclined and could come to some kind of consensus. Though that hasn't happened recently. We have had a couple of meetings, actually had one meeting, and there's a promise of another thanks to SAFE, Society for Artistic Freedom and Expression activist Coral Brune, who drew together a number of activists to talk about the new repressive or confusing police practices regarding sound amplification, where that's applied to things like a keyboard played at a low volume or even not really played much at all, but used as a rhythmic backup to an acoustic singer, where string stroker Sue Hamilton, who's been on this show, got a citation and essentially had a $250, was it, or $465 bail. I think it was reduced to a smaller sentence, even though she wasn't, she said, warned. Police officer Warren claimed she was. There was a difference of opinion there. But there seems to be a real inclination not to even work in accommodating even both sides who may have different interests. Somebody who finds music uncomfortable or unpleasant in a situation on another side that is enjoying playing it or enjoying listening to it. The issues can be worked out, particularly since Sue is willing to move along, although I think the move-along situation should not be a matter of snapping your fingers if you're a heckler and getting any musician you don't like to move along at your whim, because the police department and the city attorney will back you up with a prosecution, which seems to be what's been in the cards, at least for a couple of cases in the last year, and that's kind of an ominous precedent seems to have been set, although we are still appealing the downtown convictions of myself, Becky Johnson, and Robert Blind Bear Facer. Here's some more from the interviews of, this sounds like April 4th, downtown Pacific Avenue. And there's a lot of contrast about, you know, when their street performers do show up downtown, some of them. Mr. Twister's been around, Jay and Leoni have been around. Mandolin Mark has been around. But if you ask any of them, I think they will talk to you about the repression they've been experiencing and the kind of difficulties that they're having as street performers. They have to continue. They do it because they love to do it, or because they feel it's important to do, or because they do it because they need to make a little money. And it gets harder and harder in this economy, and particularly when the merchants and the police are methodically using these ordinances and interpreting ordinances in ways that really give a very severe kind of commercial veto to any merchant or property renter who wants to shut down First Amendment activity along the sidewalk, regardless of what the Constitution says, and even regardless of what the actual wording of the local ordinances are. That was my discovery as I tried to advise people to follow the wording of the unreasonably disturbing noise ordinance. When we advise people to tell the police officer, ask them, you know, are you fine where our noise unreasonably disturbing? And we found the police have adopted a new gambit. Or we won't tell you. It's not our opinion. It's somebody else's opinion. Because, of course, there isn't any objective standard for unreasonably disturbing. It's a ridiculous ordinance in that regard. There's no decibel requirement. And if you try to present contrary testimony, the real issue is going to be, did you follow the orders of the police officer, regardless of how loudly you were playing, simply on the basis of a complaint, which is not, of course, what the ordinance says. It does have a standard, unreasonably disturbing. It doesn't mean disturbing. It means unreasonably disturbing beyond a certain area. We're talking about music played during the day from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. Anyway, let's hear some more from Pacific Avenue, some more voices, and perhaps some notes from the street.
Mark Brody.
Mark, you said the local CDS gave you an unusual reception recently?
Yeah, the security people made me take my backpack off and leave it by the front door. And in the time it took me to go get some cigarettes and come back, somebody stole my backpack that had a $100 chess set, a $100 chess clock, my personal drawing tablet with a lot of sentimental to me drawings and other personal items, and it all got stolen. And the security people at CVS said, well, it's not our responsibility, even though they made me take it off.
Now, when was this?
It happened about a month ago. So this is April 4th. It happened somewhere around the beginning of March.
Have you ever had this experience before at CVS or any other store?
No, no. They had never in the past ever asked me to remove my backpack. They had no reason to ask me to remove my backpack. And I was just coming in to make a purchase. I shop there all the time, almost on a daily basis. And because of their crap, I wound up losing about $300 worth of belongings and irreplaceable personal items.
Had you ever been to CVS with a backpack before?
Yeah, many, many times.
Well, you're just a dirty hippie scum who's a likely kleptomaniac. That was the reason they went after you. Don't you understand?
Yeah, I do understand. Unfortunately, that's their thinking. It's sickening. It's unfair. It's disgusting. And it cost me a lot. And I feel like they are responsible. And they ought to pay me back for my damn chess set and clock.
Have you put in a claim with them?
No. Maybe I need to file a civil thing in small claims court.
It's an interesting question. You need to find out. Gee, I wish if you come to a Huff meeting, maybe we can get, or maybe I can put you in touch with somebody who can help you with that issue. Are you still giving chess lessons?
Yes, I am still giving chess lessons, and my number is 359-3931. I'm a national master of chess, and I give lessons. I charge $20 an hour or a sliding scale depending on the economic situation of the student.
Indeed. Again, the number is
359-3931.
And I must say that I did enjoy the chess lesson I had, and at a considerably reduced rate, but you were being very generous that day to people walking by on the street. You were giving lessons to people as they walked by.
Yeah, that's right. Basically, play a game for $2 and get an analysis of why you lost the game. Hopefully, every once in a blue moon I lose one, but it's not often.
I'll keep working at it. We've been talking with
Mark D. Brody.
Thank you, Mark. So, Mark, not only are you a chess master or expert, which?
Master.
Master, and you are masters above an expert and a grandmaster above a master.
That's
those
right.
You also are houseless at the moment, and you also lost your van in under unusual circumstances?
That's right, and I consider this unconstitutional. A few weeks before I lost my chess set, I had a van that was paid for, smog inspected, registered, and I had scheduled an appointment for my son to take the road test to get his license. He had already passed the written test and got the driving permit. We were going to get him his license. It was scheduled 3 more days away. I got pulled over in the van. And because my license is suspended, they impounded the van for 30 days, at $75 a day for storage, which is way far greater than the cost of the van. So they basically just stole my van from me without a trial or anything, just under, you know, the police claiming they have some reason or some probable cause that empowers them to take my property from me for 30 days. And so I lost my van, which was my home, my and my son's home. They just took everything from us. And I, God knows, I just don't consider it fair. I don't consider it constitutional. I don't consider it legal. They need to do something to turn that around and stop that. That is just like somehow they have authorized law enforcement to just legally rob you of everything you have.
If you're poor, we don't give a shit.
They don't give a shit, to put it bluntly. They worse than don't give a damn. They actually, it's like they want to inflict pain on the bottom rungs of society, the people that are have the least and are struggling the hardest to survive. They want to just keep driving them farther down and taking everything they have and making it impossible for a person to pull himself up.
Now, you may or may not haven't heard that there's going to be a protest on March 11th, a week from today, at
March?
The county building. I'm sorry, April 11th. Yes, thank you. That is at the county building, right in front of the courts, actually. We're doing a 10 o'clock meal and protest Monday, the 11th of April. We had thought that the armory was closing the day before. Now, I've gotten some information that it may have closed yesterday. I'm not sure what the story is with the armory. But in any case,
the story was that it indeed did close, I believe, on May 3rd, as we had thought. But we got misinformation via the Homeless Service Center, who apparently, or the attorney, city attorney's office, or somebody who falsely informed Steve Plage that it was closing a week later. So we postponed the protest, which isn't altering the situation. People still are now outside with essentially, there are 48, there's no actually walk-in emergency shelter beds that I'm aware of in Santa Cruz. There are programs you can get on waiting lists. But if you want to walk into a program or walk into a bed somewhere, walk into a shelter, you used to be able to at least line up and at the Homeless Service Center outside for the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program vans. It would take you to churches, and there weren't many of them. And there people were always getting, there was never enough beds for people. But at least in theory, you could possibly get involved, though. Actually, for the last decade, that whole thing has also been full with people who are vulnerable and disabled, going elderly, single women, things of that sort. Still, it was at least formally a program where you could have emergency shelter. There is no emergency shelter anymore that I'm aware of. There is the Paul Lee Loft, which is a program you get into, provided you're on their waiting list and you stay on their waiting list for a month. 2 weeks to 6 weeks, actually, depending whether you're a woman or a man and what the exigencies of the moment are. And then you may get in for a month, and then you'll be out for another month. So the fact of the matter is the situation for people is 95% of the homeless population is outside on the streets, and all of them are vulnerable to the city's municipal codes, which make it illegal to sleep after 11 o'clock at night, so-called sleeping ban, which is exactly and specifically what it is. It bans sleeping. That is an infraction crime. The bail for which I had thought was $97, but has gone up to, I believe it's now $145. I saw a citation at the protest, which one homeless person showed me. And apparently it's costing more than it used to. I don't know where they got the extra $50 from, but it's gone up. And what happens then is people go to court, and they have to, apparently you can't get a letter anymore, or I've heard it's difficult to get a letter from the Homeless Service Center stating, we were full that night. unless you happen to have the foresight or collusion with the Homeless Service Center to help swell their grant list so they can show whether they're serving more people and get more money from the government and from other sources, perhaps. If you're not on their waiting list the night you get a ticket, then at least last summer when the Peace Camp 2010 was trying to get some of the members of the Peace Camp who were sleeping outside, tried to get letters that said, we were full, the Homeless Service Center was full during the nights that tickets were issued, they wouldn't give them that letter. So this is going to come up in the trials of the Peace Camp 2010 people in the late spring, I guess, coming up actually later this month. And in May, Linda LeMaster and the Peace Camp 6, who I like to call the Santa Cruz 6, should probably call them, it's been suggested by Becky Johnson, the Santa Cruz 7, the seven people who are standing up to the penal code, curious and bizarre use of penal code 647E, which is a disorderly conduct statute. It's being used to criminalize political protesters who are peacefully and quietly protesting and or sleeping in front of a government building to demonstrate in the most vivid possible way and protest, not so much the lack of shelter, which it would be nice if there were shelter, but the fact that homeless people who are not sheltered are facing criminal charges with all the disabilities that that entails. And the protest we had, I will be playing some tape from later today, I hope, in this show, if I have time. But that is, the situation is there is no emergency walk-in shelter at the present time. And the allegation that there is a essentially a lie that is being spread to justify and prettify the Homeless Services Center's approach. And it really, well, I find it extremely disagreeable, and I also find that it's very telling that they won't give you straight answers to questions when you send them emails, when you ask them questions publicly, even if you go to Don Lane, the vice mayor, who's on the board of the Homeless Services Center, or Catherine Byers. You cannot get a straight answer from them in terms of what are the procedures for getting on the waiting list? Can you stay on the waiting list? Will you give us a receipt? Actually, some of these questions are answered, but they're answered in ways that make it difficult for you to use these procedures, or that make it obvious that they're not really making things helpful for people who are getting on these lists. So, for example, they won't give you any acknowledgement, any written proof that you're on the list, what we call a receipt, which then might be used to go to show the police officer who comes around late at night and says, "Hey, you. You know, get going. Show me your ID. I'm going to look through your property here," and asking you a series of questions that you should have no obligation to answer or pay any attention to, because you aren't engaging in criminal activity. But because you don't have any evidence that you're on the waiting list, the police officer is not influenced or bound by the new law, which was passed by the city attorney or at the instigation of the city attorney last September, which says if you are on a waiting list for the Homeless Service Center or for the River Street shelter, or if the Winter Armory shelter is full, then, first of all, your tickets will be dismissed if you're given tickets for the nights you were on the waiting list or the armory was full. And on those nights that you are given those citations, the law shall not apply to you. It's the second part of the law that's interesting, because if you present evidence to an officer that you are, in fact, meeting those conditions, the officer's responsibility, it would seem to me, is not to give you a ticket at all, because you're not subject to the law. And when I talked to other legal experts, they said, oh, no, what they really mean here is that you can present that in court as a defense. But I would argue that you can present it to the police officer and say, back off, or I'll sue you later, and we'll see where that one goes. Because it says here that in the law that this law does not apply to people who are on the waiting list, and this is a receipt that shows I'm on the waiting list. And that may be the very reason that the Homeless Service Center refuses to give those receipts, because they wish to maintain a cozy and amicable relationship with the police. I can't think of any other reason. And that's been the case for 9 months since we went, myself, attorney activist Ed Fry, former Homeless Issues Task Force chair, and now Peace Camp 2010 defendant Linda LeMaster, we went to the Homeless Service Center Board of Directors to request that they do this and ask them if they weren't going to do this, why wouldn't they do this? And we couldn't get a straight answer. All we got was, oh, we'll have to talk to the police department about that. We're not aware they ever did talk to the police department. All we know is that the city attorney does dismiss some citations, a fraction of the citations that are issued for sleeping, camping, or covering up with blankets each month. And I guess the claim is that the city attorney is dismissing all citations for those who are on the waiting list the nights of the citations. But the idea that you should be on a phantom and bogus waiting list that may or may not get you a bed in order to have the police leave you alone sounds like a combination of unnecessary and burdensome, as well as rather offensive kind of hypocrisy that's being used here, as well as a scam to get people to jump on the Homeless Service Center's programs. Even if they don't like the Homeless Service Center, even if they have some other philosophy of life, even if they've had bad experiences with the Homeless Service Center. And again, this is not to say that everything the Homeless Service Center does is wrong or bad, but this particular practice has been so persistent, their refusal to come clean, to write a letter saying, we have no space and we have no walk-in shelter. There was no space last summer, which would have been one way of essentially exposing the fraud of all the citations issued to the homeless activists last August, September, and October, and July as well, when they were protesting at City Hall under the sleeping ban, the camping ordinance, and under 647E, the lodging law, because that means that if no such shelter existed, the necessity defense would win in court, because homeless people who have no place to go have a necessity to sleep at night. And that is supposed to be the basis for, and has been the basis for, even pretrial dismissal of these kinds of tickets. When a referee, or I should say Commissioner Basket, sees a citation and a letter from the Homeless Service Center saying, we were full that night, she tells me she dismisses such tickets automatically. So, because the Homeless Service Center is no longer apparently issuing those letters, and if they are, I'm glad to hear it, but I've heard the opposite, and since they refuse to honestly state that they had no space throughout last summer, except for those on a waiting list in a very limited way, but not for people who came up that night looking for a place to sleep, they are, in fact, trying to create the illusion, or going along with the police illusion, that somehow there's shelter that people are turning down and they're instead choosing to sleep outside rather than sleep in the shelter, which may actually be a healthy choice, but is not the real situation. And they are, in fact, enabling police mistreatment of homeless people through this kind of mythology, through suggesting, well, we're not going to issue a letter honestly telling the courts and the public what's really going on. We're not going to give you a receipt that says you're on a waiting list so you can show it to the police officer so he has to back off. We're not going to have, and this is another thing, somebody on call who will tell the police department if they call in, we have no shelter tonight, please don't issue tickets, which is what you would think a decent Homeless Service Center really concerned with real homeless services, which have to do in the most basic service, allowing people to sleep, not anywhere and everywhere, but somewhere legally at night, something that they would do if they had some real concerns, other than the kind of limited bureaucratic concerns of assisting a small number of people, and of course those people who are employed in those positions as social service workers, bureaucrats, and on the board. The boards actually don't get paid, but the people who are running the place do. Anyway, you're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norse, and we aren't 101-ing, we're freak radioing. We are streaming, but I am hearing rumblings that there's kind of a rebellion in the collective to get this whole situation changed back so that we can actually get on the air again. We seem to be waiting for action from people who are at the transmitter site who are either, frankly, incompetent or indifferent or are having some problems I just cannot fathom. So I'm not trying to put them down. I am a little, frankly, upset that this is taking so long to do. And I hope that it changes soon, and I hope we can get back on the air soon. Again, the call-in number here, if you have any thoughts, all you stream listeners, is 427-3772. Let's hear some more from Mark, the chess expert, talking about his difficulties losing his van, his backpack, and suffering the kinds of things that would drive me crazy, I'll tell you.
Dramatize the fact that there's no place for the 75 to 100 people are being kicked out, that the city attorney is getting 200 plus grand to actually go after people and enforce not the suspended driving license. That's with the highway patrol. But I guess the city police, which police department went after you for that?
It was the city police. So, and I begged them not to take it. I explained that that was our home, that that was everything that I had. And they were very cruel and said, this isn't, let's make a deal. And they just left us there on the side of the road with nothing and took my home.
Who was the officer involved, do you remember?
I wish I did. I don't even remember their name.
How many police officers?
Two.
And did they say that if you could find a driver who was registered, you would let you take the van yourself?
No. And I pulled over in a legal parking spot, and I said that I would go find somebody that was a legal driver to move it to where we could stay until I got the rest of the things taken care of to for it to be completely legal for my son to drive it and get it insured. And they didn't even give me a chance to do that. I mean, I was right across the street from the shelter where I know a lot of people. I know some people that have a license that could have, you know, come and driven for me. But no, they wouldn't even give me a chance to do that.
Is that Coral Street?
Right on Highway 1, near a block away from Coral Street, near the right at the intersection of Highway 1 and 9.
How did they happen to pull you over?
That's another good question. I don't feel like they had any probable cause to even pull me over in the first place because the vehicle was registered. I didn't do any wrong maneuver in my driving. They gave no reason as to why they pulled me over. They just said, let me see your license. I showed them my ID. I told them I had a North Carolina license. They did some kind of check and said it's suspended and, you know, we're taking your vehicle.
No. And did you know your license was suspended when you were driving?
No, I didn't, but, you know, they didn't care about
was it
that.
Suspended because it had expired, or what was the reason?
I'm not even sure what the reason is, but, you know, like I said, I was in the process of trying to get my son licensed, and he had a permit, but they said he couldn't even drive it because even though he had a permit, there would have to be an adult in the car that had a driver's license with him in order for him to be able to drive. And so since they said I was suspended, I didn't qualify, so he couldn't even take over driving it. Even though we were both sober and, you know, like I said, I pulled over in a legal place to stop the vehicle, and they called the towing company instantly. I mean, the towing vehicle got there before they finished writing out the ticket for
almost
driving.
Almost like a racket.
Yeah, not almost like. It is a racket.
And what was the name of the towing company?
Rossi Towing. That's who works for our local police department, our law enforcement. That's who runs this little racket. I almost feel like I should try to go to the federal building and file some kind of civil suit against the police department and Rossi's Towing for racketeering. Do you even know where is the federal building for our district?
I mean, we don't really have a... I mean, San Jose probably has a federal building, but, I mean, you can go... There's a federal office in the sense that I think there's an FBI office in town somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I also think there is a... I know there's an office of Representative U.S., Representative Farr, a congressional rep, in the county building. I think it's the third, fourth, or fifth floor is one of the two. But that is not... The federal courts are in San Jose.
Okay.
Not that they necessarily are helpful, but, you know, the issues you raise are, of course, important to poor people, and people even who aren't homeless, but people who have vehicles who can't afford to drive it or have suddenly gotten fines for one reason or another, can't pay them, their licenses get suspended, and then they're screwed. They can't get to work.
Yeah, let me speak. It's horrible. They've made it to where people like me, and I'm sure I'm not alone, there's probably hundreds of others, they get you in a situation where it would cost you so many thousands of dollars that basically the bottom line is you're never going to get to drive for the rest of your life. So they've really screwed you, and you're probably right. These federal districts usually encompass a number of counties, and it probably is over the hill in San Jose. And I'm going to find out where it is, and I think I am going to try to file a civil suit against the city and try to change some of these policies, because fortunately... my experience, I've been through some things like this in other states in the United States, and normally when you go to the federal building, they don't give a shit about what local municipalities and so forth say. They go by the federal rules, and if you want to file a suit, they'll help you, they'll give you the paperwork, they'll say this is what you need to fill out to file a civil suit, and they will read it and give it consideration, and if it has any merit whatsoever, they will pursue the civil suit.
Have you filed a federal suit before?
Yes, I have. I filed a civil suit against the county jail in the capital of North Carolina because they would not give dental service to people who were going to be in jail for a long time, who had not been tried yet, not convicted of anything, but had been given real high bails that they could not meet, and so they're like forced to sit there and let their teeth rot, and the only thing they'll do is pull a tooth. They won't let you get any kind of real dental work there. And I filed a civil suit over that, and I don't know whatever became of it because I finally got sick of that hog farming, tobacco chewing, Bible thumping, backwoods, illiterate state, and I left before I ever found out what happened. But I
now you've come to enlightened Santa Cruz.
I've come to a supposedly more enlightened part of the country, but
they frightened you of your van and of your backpack.
Yeah, I've learned that things have begun to go downhill even here, and it saddens me.
Again, we've been talking with
Mark Brody,
who can be found as a chess maestro at
downtown on Pacific Avenue normally, and my phone number is 359-3931.
Thanks, Mark. I'm talking again a few minutes later after a masterful chess lesson where I just got badly beaten. The Latvian gambit loses again. But I've learned that you had a serious incident, not only in terms of a loss of your backpack and a loss of your vehicle, but your son was also involved after we talked about this on Free Radio before when you and I had a previous interview. How he stole a T-shirt.
That's right.
At one point, and he was charged with a felony.
That's right. He stole a $10 T-shirt. They charged him with a felony, robbery, I guess they called it, and he was released on his own recognizance. And then a few weeks later, after he was released, We were sitting one night in the comfort of our apartment where we moved in with this girlfriend of his. And one night there's like seriously heavy banging on the door over and over, which I ignored.
About what time of night?
Getting towards 10 o'clock at night, I was in bed trying to go to sleep at the time. I wasn't feeling that well. And they bang on the door a while, and since I ignored it, they shine flashlights in the window, but my bed was hidden behind a sheet, so they couldn't really see my face. And after about 15 minutes of this banging, no announcement, no verbiage of any kind, they go, either open up or we're going to kick the door in and come in and grab David. Still no identification of who they are or why they were saying this. So finally, I wanted to know because I was feeling like maybe it's somebody that has a beef with him. Maybe I'm in some danger here. Do I need to call the police?
We're going to have to wait on that because we have a scheduled interview now with Mike Rhodes of Fresno. I think that's Mike calling in now, but we'll find out. Hey there, you're on Free Radio Stream.
Hey, Robert, it's Mike Rhodes in Fresno.
Just as I suspected, the evil Mike Rhodes.
That's me.
Are you the man who's been writing these treasonous stories attacking Fresno First Steps Home and other well-intended officials of the city of Fresno?
Well, that might be what some of the city officials would say, but I would say that I'm printing the truth.
Printing the truth, but sometimes the truth is ill-advised because the public doesn't know what to do with it. Aren't you creating a difficult situation for our city officials in Fresno?
Well, here's the thing, is that city policy is leaving homeless people in Fresno to die on the streets. There have been so many deaths in the last year, and I would say it's directly attributable to city policy, which leads to people literally dying on the street. And so, you know, you got to balance, you know, whether the truth about city policy is it worse to know that, or is it worse for people to be dying because of it?
Well, for those who are interested, Mike, I know you've written an article. And it's online, Fresno First Steps Home at indiebay.org/Central Valley. Fresno First Steps Home. I guess if people Google for Mike Rhodes, Fresno First Steps Home, they can find it too. In this, you have some photos of the hill, one of the homeless encampments. And you're asking, is Fresno First Steps Home helping to end homelessness, or is it part of a right-wing scheme to create the illusion that the city is doing something while things get worse and worse for the homeless? It sounds like a rhetorical question, actually, but maybe it's a serious one because you have seriously given people like former homeless czar Greg, what was Barson, was that his name?
It's Greg Barfield.
Barfield, thank you. You've given him a lot of rope. You know, you've tried to, work with city officials in hoping to get dumpsters and water service and trash pickups and other amenities, not to mention decriminalization at some level for literally thousands of homeless people in Fresno, and yet what you have is increasing number of encampments and yet increasing crackdown on homeless people both in and outside of encampments?
Yeah, you got to look back historically on what the city policy was regarding the homeless in Fresno. 5 years ago, they were simply coming through with bulldozers and taking tents and putting them in the back of garbage trucks and destroying all the property that homeless people had. And when we stopped that and they started talking about providing housing vouchers, to me that sounded like an improvement. But as time has gone by, I've come to the conclusion that there was a lack of sincerity on the part of the city of Fresno in providing housing for the homeless. And in fact, what their policy led to was the illusion that they're doing something to end homelessness without the substance of it. And one of the telling signs of this was almost immediately after the homeless czar was hired, is they removed all funding for any homeless projects in the city of Fresno from the budget. And they set up a 501c3 nonprofit privatizing the effort to address homelessness. And what we found in asking some questions about where the money is gone, this program, Fresno First Steps Home, which is the name of the foundation, was brought out with great fanfare. The mayor and many others went on television encouraging people in Fresno not to give their money to the homeless because it would only be used for bad things, presumably food and things that would help them survive. So they wanted people to give them the money and not the homeless, and so that they could provide housing and get them off of the street. And that was what they said, that we want, they want the money so that they could fund these homeless initiatives.
Now, this program began when? When did the mayor make this fine announcement?
It was in the early part of last year. So I'm thinking, February, March, something like that. I have to go back and look exactly. But it's been going for about a year.
But in fact, prior to that, was there not $1 million in each annual budget to deal with homeless people that was simply unspent year after year?
Well, yeah, there was that. And the money that they did spend was poorly used. For example, I did convince them at one point to put some portable toilets and trash bins at an encampment. And it cost, they were being billed $13,000 a month for like three portable toilets and a trash bin. Something that should have cost about $200 or $300 was costing them $13,000, which is just ridiculous.
Homeless people were probably destroying them and ruining them. Our former mayor, Mike Rotkin, has assured us that's why we can't have 24-hour bathrooms or porta-potties, because they all get destroyed.
Well, I have personally been paying for a couple of them out on F Street in downtown Fresno, and they're still there. They haven't been destroyed, and people use them, and they appreciate it. The city of Fresno also used a lot of their money to buy and put up a bunch of tool sheds, which they put on some property that is owned by the Poverello House. Poverello House is a social service agency here in Fresno. And so these tool sheds, which are just like tool sheds you'd put in your backyard and put tools in it, they put two homeless people per shed in these. They don't have running water, they don't have toilets, they don't have heating or cooling.
This is the famous dog houses for the homeless that we talked about 3 years ago, right?
Yeah, and that's the kind of thing that the city of Fresno used their money for when they had it in their budget. But in the last year, they have removed all money for homelessness, and set up this 501c3, a nonprofit organization, and encouraged people to donate to it. Well, people were asking me.
Well, now, neoliberals have always told us that, private enterprise can do it better. So what's the record now, private enterprise? I assume they've stepped in and made some major improvements?
People were asking me out on the street, what are they doing with the money? Because we haven't seen it. We don't see anything that's happening. I mean, the interesting thing, Robert, is that on the streets of Fresno, where homeless people live, there is no money at all going to help them. And they're just kind of on their own, recycling cans and, you know, doing a lot of jobs to keep themselves alive. You know, and they know that there's millions of dollars coming into the city of Fresno to address the homeless issue. And where that money is going is mostly through HUD, and it's going to developers to develop some low-income housing, which is supposed to address homelessness. And so one of those projects is a 60-some unit project, and it'll build these units that will be single resident occupancy, some of them specified for mental health, homeless people who have mental health issues. And they're spending $9.1 million on that one project. And the developer that got the contract is the same guy who was the chairperson of writing the 10-year plan to end homelessness here. So it's kind of a tidy circle that they have. But the point being that the money to help homeless people isn't getting to where it needs to get, and that is, you know, basic public services for the homeless. And so this Fresno First Steps Home, I started making inquiries about where the money had gone about a week ago, and I got rebuffed by Greg Barfield, who was the homeless czar. He transferred to another position at City Hall. And he claims that they don't have to provide that information because this is not a City of Fresno project. So they're exempt from any California Public Record Act request. So I said, well, fine, who do I ask then about your financial record? And there was no response. Another homeless advocate in Fresno inquired about this issue because I said, hey, you know, do you care about what's happening with the money? And he wrote to Greg, and Greg responded to him, you know, as he would not respond to me because I've been somewhat critical of his actions recently. But he did respond to this other person who does support what the city is doing, but does nudge them to do better. So he responded to this person by saying, well, we haven't really spent very much of the money. What we have spent it on is corporate filing fees and some promotional material for Fresno First Steps Home, which is probably these cards that they hand out to people telling them to call. They hand these cards out to people who want to help the homeless. So if a homeless person asks them for money, they give them a card that suggests they call 211, which then, I don't know, I've never called it, but I presume that it's sort of a directory or a referral network where they say, oh, well, you could go to the Poverello House to get a meal, or you can go to the Rescue Mission and spend the night. But
why not? Why can't they do that? What are you, some kind of malcontent, Mike? I mean, you know, here they are providing all these services, and on top of that, small cards directing the handicapped homeless how to use a phone, presuming they can find 50 cents. Of course, that might be involved panhandling, to make a phone call. You have some objection to this whole procedure?
Well, I think it creates an illusion that the city is actually doing something about homelessness, when in fact they're not. And look, if somebody were to call, there's not, Fresno's different than Santa Cruz in that there's approximately 15,000 homeless people here, many of them on the streets of Fresno, some of them sleeping in cars, some of them on couches. There's about 250 beds, shelter beds in Fresno that are full all the time. So somebody is told to call the Rescue Mission or some other place for a bed, they're just not available. So it gives the illusion that there's some answer there, but there is in fact not. And the fact that all that this Fresno First Steps Home has done with their money is to pay for corporate filing fees and promotion for themselves and their program, which doesn't help homeless people, is you know, pretty discouraging, and I think needs to be exposed to the public.
You know, I know that, I mean, I, of course, obviously, but the fact is, it's interesting, you've exposed prior schemes by prior mayors and prior failures to give away this money. And in fact, it was due to your intervention and that of a number of other people, your daughter with a camera or a video, which resulted in the famous Kincaid lawsuit, which I guess sort of stopped them from destroying tents, although I guess they're now, what, carting them away to places where they keep them in waterlogged areas where they get ruined anyway, right?
Well, it did get their attention, and for whether it's good or bad, lawsuits tend to get the attention of the city of Fresno, and sometimes that's the only thing that does. So once there was this $2.3 million settlement, which was based around their taking and immediately destroying homeless people's property, they did change their policy. And the policy then became that they have to store homeless people's property for 90 days.
But as I said, you found that the storage facilities, at least in one or two, several cases, was such that it damaged the property beyond use.
Well, yeah. The first instance when they conducted a cleanup, as they call them, out by Roding Park and hauled homeless people's property away, I took a homeless woman down to reclaim her property about 2 weeks later, and they had put they put this big container that was open on the top out in a parking lot.
Well, that's a step forward from what they do in Santa Cruz. I went over to reclaim homeless property that was taken in the Peace Camp 2010 protests of last summer, and it has simply been left out in the rain in the back of the police station for 3 months. Some of it was in plastic bags and was okay. The signs that we were using were ruined. And the tables were, one of the tables at least was ruined. So it's, you know, it seems like police departments everywhere have a certain formula or a certain laissez-faire attitude for doing this. But what I was asking you, because we've talked about this, this is like 4 or 5 years old, or 3 or 4 years old, this discussion about this particular visit, and you've documented it. You've shown photos of it on indiebay.org/Central Valley. I'm asking you, has it improved? Is property still being taken? Is it being better stored? What's happening with that?
Actually, you know, after we released the video of their destroying homeless people's property, and we got the attorneys involved in the case to send a letter to the attorneys for the city, then it did change. They then put them in their property in cured containers that were sealed from the rain. So that did change. It's not ideal, but it did change.
And the other thing that
changed is that they stopped a lot of, they have a lot fewer of these cleanups taking place. In fact, they almost never do them anymore, and when they do a cleanup, they only take what is really garbage. And the way you know that is because what's happened in the encampment is the total abandonment of any city involvement in the encampments at all. And you could say, well, that's a good thing because the city's not attacking them, which is, yeah, that's better than them attacking homeless people. But what's happened is you just have these huge piles of garbage. You know, there's no portable toilet, so people defecate everywhere. There's garbage and there's no drinking water. So it's a pretty bleak environment. And people have been forced. They have pushed people from any areas that are visible to the public. And so people are ending up on some pretty obscure places like, the hill where there's several pictures of that is way, south in the industrial part of the city. So the city policy has shifted, but it's like shifted towards the complete abandonment of helping the homeless in any way. It's almost like they don't exist as far as the city is concerned. So,
what about police enforcement? You're saying there's no, police are simply ignoring homeless people sleeping at night provided they go to their ghetto?
I haven't had any complaints for a while now. The last complaint I had was back in January that the city police had come and were telling people that they had to move from F Street, which is an encampment just south of Ventura. And they threatened them, and the folks said that they weren't causing any harm. The police said, well, we've been getting complaints. The folks said, who's been complaining? And turns out the major complainant, at least according to the police, was Greg Barfield, who is the former homeless czar in Fresno. So they said, screw that. We're not going anywhere. And they didn't. And so the police came back a couple more times, threatened them a few more times, but they never did anything to force them to move. And they're there today. The encampment has gotten much larger.
Let me ask you about that. How many people are actually in encampments where, well, it sounds like conditions are sort of New York tenement style, but worse from the early 20th century. But still, people have each other. How many people are actually gathered together in groups of the 15,000 homeless in Fresno?
Well, in the downtown area, I would put the number about 2,000. It might be 1,500, it might be 3,000. I don't really know, but it's a lot. And so in each of these encampments now, you have 100, 200, you know, maybe even 300 people in some of the bigger encampments. There's one on Santa Fe, I think a picture up of that is enormous and getting larger all the time.
What kind of organization are in these encampments? How do people address their own problems? What do they do? Have you had any reports or what's going on with respect to that?
It varies from camp to camp. People tend to go to camps where they're comfortable with. They know people there. They fit in. The camp on F Street, for example, I know they have meetings fairly regularly. There's a couple of people that sort of take some leadership role in things that, you know, pull people together to have meetings and talk about it. I mentioned that we put these portable toilets down there, and so there was discussion about, okay, you know, what will our policy be on that? Some people wanted to lock them, and so people would have to come and get a key so that they could use them. And other people felt, well, just leave them open and anybody could get in there. And the problem is that everybody uses them, and so they get filled up really quickly. We're trying to get to a point where we have so many of them there that that doesn't become a problem, but, you know, we haven't gotten to that point yet. So on F Street, you have some self-organization. There's some natural leadership there. They get together. They have meetings and talk these things through.
So is this are these the Hoovervilles or the Obamavilles, you know, of the 21st century?
Well, in Fresno, it does seem to be sort of developing that way, and in most other places that I've seen around the valley here, and in, you know, San Francisco and Santa Cruz, I just don't see these large encampments that develop. And what starts to happen after a while, and what's happened here, is that people start putting more permanent structures up. They'll put foundations in, framed walls, pitched roofs, and pretty soon, you know, you have a regular neighborhood that just has no services that are being provided to it by the city of Fresno. There's no drinking water, no trash pickup, but for all other intents and purposes, it's just another neighborhood, although a very poor one.
And has that actually happened to F Street? Has that happened to any of these encampments? Their permanent structures have gone up and stayed up?
Yeah. I mean, F Street only started up about December of this last year. But over on H Street, there is an encampment there that's been there for several years now. And I mean, it's just a permanent fixture of that neighborhood. There are row upon row upon row of houses that are built on a sidewalk and an abandoned overpass, and under that overpass, and these have been there for years. I mean, they've even got at that encampment, they've set up, the homeless people that live there have set up a memorial for the homeless people in that area that have died. You can see a photo of that memorial where they have little gravestones for, you know, 40, 50 people.
Is there any active homeless organization from the grassroots of the in these encampments that might draw them together to engage in some kind of united political action?
Hard to do. I mean, there's a lot of countervailing currents that take place within the homeless encampment, and I would love to see self-organization where people are organizing in their self-interest and becoming a political force in the community. But frankly, Robert, I haven't seen that. I know there are some good people out there that have good intentions, but as far as organization and that turning into political power, it hasn't developed yet.
What's the economy looking like in Fresno compared to a year ago in terms of employment and in terms of income, foreclosures, and so forth?
Well, our unemployment rate, you know, official unemployment rate is about 20%. There are, interestingly, abandoned foreclosed homes everywhere. In fact, right across the street from the homeless encampment are several homes that are boarded up and abandoned, probably bank-owned. There are thousands of vacant homes in Fresno. There's more than enough housing here if it was used to meet people's needs, but obviously the banks are not opening those homes up for the people that need them.
And neither are the progressives and the homeless people themselves occupying those homes, right?
Well, I don't know about that. I wouldn't go so far as to say that people aren't occupying homes. But it's not something that is openly discussed as a strategy here. It's simply done from one, you know, with one group or another. It, you know, certainly homeless people can't break into houses and use them when they can. And the police's response to that usually is, when they find out about it, is that they'll go in and they'll ask people to leave. And they don't arrest them, they don't do much else. But, you know, what we suspect is if there was a politically led movement here to publicly take over bank-owned and foreclosed homes, that it would be targeted by the police and there would be repression. So, as far as I'm concerned, you know, if people are doing that, good, because people need housing, and housing should be a human right. But is there a organized effort to do that? Not that I know of.
Well, I know that last December, I believe it was, maybe I'm thinking of December before last, weren't you guys threatening to provide maps to all the foreclosed homes and going to distribute them if there wasn't some action by the city on some basic issue on homeless civil rights or homeless entitlements?
Yeah, we held a press conference, and that was in December of 2009 on Human Rights Day. And we had a big map that had a list, you know, pins in all the areas where homes were bank foreclosed and, you know, they're boarded up. So we did provide that map, and I think people did print them up and did distribute them. So, you know, but things change all the time. You'd have to have, you know, updated maps probably monthly in order to keep current. As far as I know, nobody's doing that.
I thought it was a great idea, actually. I mean, it went to really the heart of the issue, housing that was not being used and people who needed to use it.
Yeah.
Very straightforward.
It makes perfect sense.
You know, I don't think they have enough police to, if people occupy, if there was a general movement to occupy housing, that would, it couldn't be stopped if it were done, you know, with sufficient, if it were done like is happening, what happened over in Tunisia and Egypt, although there, of course, it's a movement for political rights and an end to the dictatorships, that the U.S. supported dictatorships there. But, you know, it could be, it's in other eras, it's happened that people have taken over what they need to take over.
Well, if the 15,000 or so homeless people in Fresno were to be politically united and develop a strategy of that nature, it would definitely shake things up a lot. The struggle here would move to a whole new level.
What about allied groups? Supposedly allied groups of the homeless people are kind of the pariahs. We have had union rallies where, you know, when one person mentions the homeless, everybody else sort of shudders and backs off, and union people don't send reps to homeless rallies and so forth. There's this division, ditto with student organizations, where you have these isolated circumstances happening. You're involved with you edit a newspaper, the Community Alliance newspaper.
Right.
That involves itself in a number of issues, whether it's anti-war, environmental, gay, lesbian, bi, transsexual, human rights for youth, police abuse. All these are issues, and homeless issues, that your newspaper is trying to cover, right?
I think people at this point in this community see homeless rights issues, a right to housing, as being integral in the struggle for peace, social, and economic justice. They don't make a differentiation between that and police accountability or labor rights. It's just part of the environment.
But you can't get the unions down there to support the homeless, I'll bet.
Well, you know, it's interesting.
Or can you? I'm amazed if you could.
Well, I mean, if there was something to focus people's attention on, we would probably get some union support. I mean, there's unions and there's unions. Different locals are more progressive than others.
Have any unions ever supported any homeless protests in the last 5 years?
Well, we've certainly had union organizers, staff, members come out to rallies and sleep-ins and the sorts of things that we've done. Now, if you're talking about officially sanctioned groups of union members coming out in an organized fashion, there's less of that. But on the other hand, really, I don't see any hostility from organized labor toward homeless people.
No, I mean, but in terms of activism to change the laws that criminalize the homeless, or to, you know, end this, you'll get these protests, you know, supporting Wisconsin, as indeed people should be supporting, you know, the upsurge in Wisconsin against, well, to some extent against the attacks on labor there, but when, of course, if they really are supporting mostly Democratic Party policy positions instead of the real rights of working people, although some of that does come out, do you find ever, I mean, is there, well, you're saying that union people do show up at these rallies.
The other thing, Robert, is like, okay, there was a march here about a week ago supporting labor rights because they're under attack. And, you know, I couldn't identify any homeless people at that march. You know, there wasn't any, you know, LGBT activists there either. What tends to happen here is that people have the issues that they are passionate about, and they focus narrowly on those issues. That's one of our challenges that we have, is to build a more united progressive movement. And unfortunately, we're not there yet. And I, you know, as much as I would like to see that happen, and I encourage people to support each other's struggles, there's not enough of that does take place. And it's, you know, it's true. It works across all different issues.
What's on the horizon for the next few months in Fresno that people should know about? I know there's a Bank of America protest coming up on Monday in Santa Cruz. We've been having a variety of protests around the closing of the armory and the criminalization of the poor and the wars, expanding the wars in Libya and Iraq and Afghanistan. But what's happening in Fresno?
Well, probably a lot of the same things that are happening in Santa Cruz. There are people working on multiple fronts to try to build a more sane society. And, you know,
any specifics? Anything any specific events coming up that you might want to mention? Or
one thing that kind of grabbed my attention lately is that there's a group that is trying to pull all the different progressive groups together in the fall for a conference in Fresno to build some kind of united strategy. They're going to bring in Jim Hightower to speak, and the strategy is to get people to get together and look at all the issues and figure out a way, if there's a way that we could all work together to build political power in this community that would benefit all of us. Because otherwise we're just a whole bunch of different groups, and they're all struggling against issues, and sometimes we have minor victories, and you know, whenever we do, that's a great thing, but there's always something else over here that's coming up that's got to take our attention. And there's not enough unity to be an effective force. And so there's this effort that'll take place in the fall here that will, the goal is to get everybody together to try to build a common strategy. So you'd have, you know, people who are homeless advocates, you'd have people who are labor activists, people who are focusing on electoral strategies, who would all come together and see if there's unity that can be built that would benefit us all.
We've been talking with Mike Rhodes, Community Alliance editor, author of many different articles on homeless civil rights struggles on indiebay.org/Central Valley. Mike, I would probably keep throwing questions at you, but you told me you only had half an hour, and it's been 37 minutes.
So. Okay, well, Robert, I always appreciate the opportunity to talk with you. I learn a lot by talking to you. You ask really good questions, and I just appreciate the opportunity to be able to talk to you from time to time.
Well, I'm a little, you know, I'm asking you a lot of gloomy stuff, and, you know, I'm... But you know, you're out there. I know very few people who are out there trying to fund porta potties. There were two people in Santa Cruz who tried to do that and did that for 3 months. Paul Lee and I guess Ed Fry facilitated that. But it's, you know, it's rare. And we have a similar situation. There's this very, grim sort of, lack of understanding and lack of awareness that we're all in the, you know, increasingly close to that abyss, although I guess I'm told the economy is recovering. Is that true?
Not here. Hey, you know, I just throw out an idea. The way I'm able to pay for the portable toilet and the trash bin, we have a huge trash bin out there, too, and we'll probably be putting more out before long, but the way that I'm able to afford to do that is I've been taking, and it sort of has... several benefits to it. I've been taking people out on tours of the homeless encampments in downtown Fresno. So I'll get 5 to 10 people and we'll walk around and I'll talk to them about, you know, the history of the struggle, the current condition, where we're at now, how we got here. People will ask questions. I'll introduce them to homeless people. They'll talk and tell their story. And I charge people to do this, $20 each. And so that money goes into paying for the portable toilets and trash bin. And you'd be surprised at all the people that come. I've had people, you know, from the Democratic Party, from lots of students, lots of different people coming from different interests, but they want to see firsthand what's going on in the homeless encampment and they're willing to pay for it. So
how can people join? How can people join the? Do you have a regularly scheduled? I think I catch your drift. You're suggesting perhaps that could be done in Santa Cruz. But if somebody wanted to visit Fresno and join one of your tours of the Haight-Ashbury, no, I'm sorry, of the F Street encampments, for example, what would they do? How would they? Is it every Monday at 5 o'clock? I mean, when is it?
No, I've been setting them up by if people would email me. That would be the best way to get information about when the next tours will be.
Is it possible for you to actually make a video of one of these tours so you can then perhaps sell it or pass it on the Internet to those who can't make it to Fresno to see what's actually happening?
I hadn't gotten that far yet, but I'm sure that's a possibility.
I'd be happy to kick down a little from this end to try to help pay for some of the expenses because that would be a valuable video to have, I think.
Yeah, I just did a PowerPoint presentation where I put a lot of pictures and some video in it and took it up to Merced, the university, last Saturday, and I was the keynote speaker there. Philip Mangano, who is sort of the national czar for homelessness, spoke later. He also spoke there, but I was able to frame the issue of homelessness and how to end it. And how we should be doing to end homelessness. Philip Mangano is really an interesting guy because he has all this social justice rhetoric, but what his results are is that it leads to more of the same. And even though he talks about ending homelessness and that's what his goal is, the result here, and he came and did his dog and pony show here too, and the result was that it simply created the illusion that something was going to be done to end homelessness. It fooled a lot of people for a long time, but not anymore.
Really? So the Democrat, the city council of Fresno is turning around and looking for ways to reclaim their the money that is being siphoned off by this 501c3 profit. Nonprofit that we were talking about originally that is, you know, buying, doing corporate filings and PR, but not doing anything toward really addressing homeless issues?
Well, no, I wouldn't go that far. I'm not saying that the politicians in Fresno are onto this yet. We're just starting to probe this and to put the information out there that we're finding out, and we're hopeful that it'll turn around. What I'm saying is that people here, homeless advocates, and the homeless people themselves are starting to realize that this whole effort by developing a 10-year plan and 501c3 is a sham and that it's not working and that the money has been misused or not used at all to help the homeless.
Well, didn't we realize that like 10 years ago when they cooked up this Bush's 10-year plan to end homelessness bullshit, which, as you know, it's the continuum of care, all these different devices that have nothing to do, that are all cover devices for essentially, you know, whatever political action the development forces of the city want to do while, you know, shoving aside the real issue of civil rights and real services for homeless people. I don't know. I mean, that's how it seemed to me. They talk this issue to death, and that's what they do. That's their function. They get you to talk about it. And in a way, I criticize myself because I'm on the radio talking about this and have been doing for 2 decades, blah, blah, blah. I mean, occasionally I get out there and do a protest, and, you know, occasionally we do some feedings and we put out some literature, but you know, the hard issues remain unaddressed in any continuous and consistent way. And I guess I was going to ask you this PowerPoint presentation you did up at Merced. Did you make a video or an audio of it? Is it available for us to view? Those of us who are unable to get to the university in Merced at the same time you were there.
Yeah. You know, I haven't put it anywhere. I should try to see if I could put that on IndieBay, and if I could figure out how to do it, and it will be on IndieBay/Central Valley.
That would be great.
Yeah. Would be good.
Well, Mike, again, now you're really getting into the 45-minute zone, I've got to tell you. You probably got better things to do, like actually some real work or maybe make some money so you can actually pay for your mortgage or whatever. You own your home, right?
Yeah, I'm housed.
Yeah,
so,
that's good.
I'm really lucky to have a place to live. But I think talking with you and your audience is an important thing to do. Also, in addition to whatever writing or pictures I take, talking with you is just as important as all that. But I do have to go now. And like I said, I appreciate you giving me time on the air.
And give me your email address so folks, if they want to get in touch with you, can by email.
Sure. It's my name, Mike Rhodes, MikeRhodes, at Comcast.net.
Hey. Thanks a lot, Mike.
Thanks, Robert. Talk to you again soon.
I appreciate it. Bye-bye. And that was Mike Rhodes of Fresno. You can read his stuff and see his photos on IndyBay, IndyBay.org/Central Valley. And it's just look on the right side of the screen. You'll see some of his stories there along with other stories IndyBay has written or writers have put up on IndyBay. Impressive what he does. I wish I had the facility he does to do what he does. It's amazing, and he does this on a variety of issues. You can hear some of his older discussions on this issue if you go to the Huff website, which will soon be up again, we hope, and then just search for Rhodes, R-H-O-D-E-S. We have a caller. Amazing. Hi there. You're on Free Radio with Robert.
Hello, Robert. Sergio.
How's it going?
Study English, Hartnell College. Enjoy your show.
I'm glad. I'm glad, man.
I'm confused, Robert.
You are?
Well, you say like Steve Argue?
What are you confused about there, caller?
Well, he's an activist, right?
What's
Steve
that?
Argue?
Because I'm... sorry, say that again?
What? Steve Argue is an activist.
Oh, Steve Argue. Group. Yes, what about Steve?
Well, Steve Argues. That's the correct English.
Steve argues is what you're saying.
No, Steve argues. That's how I am being taught English.
I see. Well, there you go. I can't really comment on that except that Steve argue is we actually was
okay. Forget about that. How about the lady who sold glass to the miners?
Who stole what?
The lady, the shopkeeper, head shop you call it in this country, who sold glass to the miners.
Oh, who they alleged sold glass alleged. To the miners,
well,
yeah.
I mean, are you Japanese? She sold grass, no?
Well, both. They claim grass and glass, but of course this was...
Well, which one? You know...
I think they claim both, actually.
Well, you know, you have to clean up your act, man.
Grass
she sold... And you just said that people go to Fresno to visit Haight-Ashbury?
I was making a reference that in Haight-Ashbury they had these tour buses that would go through and show the hippies. Similarly, Mike Rhodes does a tour that shows the homeless, but I think he's doing it for a better purpose than commercial purposes, such as they used
to
do.
Well, you know, Robert, I've been in this country just for 6 months, and I think I'm going to leave it.
Well, what can I say, caller?
Well, because you know, Steve argued... She says grass. The tour. Haight-Ashbury was 68 months. This is the 21st century. Wake up!
Well, thank you, caller.
Oh, all right. Thank you.
And thank you for that call. It's always nice to know that somebody, however cranky they may sound, is listening down there. And thank you for calling in. I'm glad to hear you. We've got about 12 minutes before Uncle Dennis comes. Striding into the studio, hopefully with good news about his plans to actually get the station back on the air as well as being on the stream, though it sounds like we're hearing a few people. I'm going to play a little more of the street interview with Mark, the chess expert, who was talking about his son's situation when his son was stole a T-shirt. Actually, I don't even know if it was stolen. I heard a previous interview where the allegation was theft. But it wasn't necessarily what actually happened. We had an interview with Mark and his son David some months ago when I ran into him on the street. But anyway, let's hear a little bit of that because that's probably going to round out the rest of the hour, and then we're going to be I'm going to be on the road, and we'll be back on Sunday, I think, unless I find something more meaningful to do with my life, which could always happen, folks. Watch out. That'll be Sunday at 9:30 in the morning, which you can check the show out again, and away we'll go. Let's hear some more of this interview from, I think it was April 4th or thereabouts, maybe a little later, talking with Mark, the chess master.
Verbiage of any kind, they go, either open up or we're going to kick the door in and come in and grab David. Still no identification of who they are or why they were saying this. So finally, I wanted to know because I was feeling like maybe it's somebody that has a beef with him. Maybe I'm in some danger here. Do I need to call the police? Do I need to get a weapon ready to bash somebody's head if they come in the door? And I went to the front door and I said, "Who the hell is it?" And then finally, at that point, they identified themselves as being deputies of the sheriff's office and said, we have a warrant for David. So I was highly indignant about that because I think I thought they were required to identify themselves from the beginning by going and banging on somebody's door and making a verbal threat like that without saying that they're representatives of law enforcement. They're lucky they didn't get shot. Because I was in fear somebody was just simply trying to break into our home. And I think that's an egregious abuse of their authority or power or whatever that they don't know. They should know, but apparently they don't know how they are supposed to do their job.
Now, how many deputies were there?
Two deputies.
What was the nature of the arrest warrant? What was it for?
They finally, after they said that they were deputies of the sheriff's office and that they did have a warrant, I let them in. They arrested my son.
Proper procedure is to say, slip the warrant under the door and I'll take a look at it. And you see if the warrant is properly put together. It identifies someone who's there. You know, it's dated properly, signed by a judge. Although I'm not often, you know, too conversant with the technicalities. That's what you're supposed to do, I'm told. Go ahead.
That sounds very reasonable to me, and they certainly didn't do anything of that kind.
You have to insist on it or they won't.
I see. And so when I did let them in, they finally said that they had a warrant to arrest David. And it wasn't until after I let them in and they found, located him and handcuffed him that they finally said to him, "You're under arrest." And he said, "What for?" Because neither one of us had any idea what he had done wrong. And they said, "Domestic violence." Both of us were in shock. I said, "Against whom?" And they said, "His girlfriend, the
who had been gone for a number of weeks,
who had been gone for days, and apparently she had called them and filed a complaint against him, and with no physical evidence, no kind of bruise or harm, no visible harm to her, no witness, nothing but her saying that he did something, they generated a warrant and arrested him for domestic violence.
Currently in jail on that warrant?
And he is currently in jail. He went ahead and pleaded guilty for stealing the T-shirt. And although I heavily advised him against it, and she even said the next day when she showed up that she had no intention of pressing charges, that she just wanted to get rid of him, she immediately hopped in bed with this guy that was supposed to be one of my son's friends, and so that, I guess, is the bottom line. She wanted to get rid of him and get together with this other guy.
Why didn't you just say so? I mean, would he have left?
Yes, that's why I'm so hurt and insulted by the whole incident, because she knew she could have just come to me and said, Dad, I don't really want to be with David anymore, and the two of us would have just promptly left within minutes, at, you know, or at least within the time it would have taken me to arrange somebody to come help me get our belongings out of there. That's all she had to do, and instead she did that, and then my son, against my vigorous protest, pleaded guilty not only to stealing the T-shirt, which he did do, but he pleaded to domestic violence as well, and they gave him concurrent sentences of 120 days. You know, thank God they were...
Two felonies or misdemeanors?
I believe just a felony for the T-shirt. I think the violence...
A pretty expensive T-shirt, though.
It was a $10 T-shirt.
Yeah, but $10 goes a long way these days.
No, it doesn't.
No, it doesn't.
But, you know, the domestic thing is just a misdemeanor. But he did agree to go to, treatment for domestic violence. He's going to have to be in therapy for a year. And if he messes up and misses some appointments or something and doesn't complete that course, they can revoke it and give him a year in prison. So I tried to convince him not to plead to that charge, because I don't feel he was guilty of it, but I think, you know, being in jail, you know how they torment you in jail, or maybe if you've never been, you don't know.
I've been in jail, but I mean, you do want to get out of jail.
You just want to get it over with.
You really have to realize that it's going to be much longer if you do.
Right, and so bottom line is, you know, he got 120 days in jail, and he'll be there for at least the next month and a half before he gets out. But I just resent the fact that she made that charge, then said that, no, I don't really want to press charges, but it's too late. She's already inflicted the damage, and now he's got that mark on him as, oh, he committed domestic violence. No, he didn't commit domestic violence.
Is there a backstory that you may not know between the two of them, you think, or you're pretty sure you know all the facts?
I don't know everything. I wasn't around them 24 hours a day, so who's to say? All I know is this. I saw her the very next day, and it's quite clear that there is no bruise, no limping, nothing hurting, nothing wrong with her, nothing that indicated to me that she had been the victim of any violence. I'm not a doctor, but I mean...
You gave a date when she said the violence happened, and you knew, you saw her the day after that date?
I don't know the exact date she was claiming that it occurred, and, you know, I just have to confess I'm ignorant of all the facts, but I do know this. She said, I have no intention of pressing the charge, but it was too late.
You haven't had conversations with her afterward since then?
I moved out as soon as I possibly could. I had to wait till I got my disability check on the first of this month, and as soon as that occurred, I picked up everything I owned and got out of there under the extreme urging from my counselor, who said she could make up a story about you and get you in trouble for some kind of sexual or physical assault under some kind of false pretenses. I strongly advise you to get out of there.
The name of the person involved, what's her name?
Cassie Perdue.
The name of your son?
My son is David Brody.
And, of course, you are the world-famous...
Mark D. Brody.
A chess player to beat. Good luck.
The highly renowned author, painter, chess master, psychologist and software engineer, Mark D. Brody.
Not to mention the soft-hearted Mark D. Brody.
Yeah, that's a fact.
You have a look. You look like you're soft-hearted. I can't tell. I've only seen you a couple times. Thank you, Mark.
And that's almost it for Bathroom Spears Brothers. It looks like we may have a caller here. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Robert.
Sergio here. You say there are hippie chicks in Fresno?
My goodness. You're going to have to speak a little slower. I'm an old guy. My ears are slow.
You say there are hippie chicks in Fresno?
Chicks in Fresno.
I can't find any hippie chicks out here.
I can't tell you, man. I'm in Santa Cruz. What can I say?
Well, you talked to the guy in Fresno. You said they have Haight-Ashbury tours.
No. They had Haight-Ashbury tours in the Haight-Ashbury in the 60s.
Well, why do you say that there must be hippie chicks? There are no hippie chicks up here. I have come here to meet some hippie chicks.
Well, I wish you luck with that.
Well, should I go to Fresno or Stanger?
Well, I'm going to leave that up to you.
You are disseminating false information.
Well, of course. What else would I do? I mean, this is free radio.
You know, you are a subversive.
That's a known fact.
You are using this information to basically overthrow the United States government.
But not doing it very effectively.
No.